So welcome everyone to the second talk of the four talk series, eight classes in total of the Brahma Viharas, the abodes of the Brahma, Brahman, the abodes of God, the resting places of the gods. We make it a little too aloof, don't we? It's a little too fantastic, outstretched when it's the abodes of the God. But it's within our own reach as well. And I hope that the series will make that explainable and approachable when we start talking about these states of metta and karuna, compassion. Compassion is the talk this evening. Compassion. That compassion is that when love, which is metta, touches pain or suffering in the world, the perception of love changes to compassion, which is the wanting of the heart to alleviate that suffering, the wish for it to be alleviated. It's in metta, metta is a very allowing, relaxing, settled energy, basic warmth of heart. Whereas I perceive compassion to be a very engaged energy, a very active energy. And in the Theravada or Vipassana tradition, metta is sort of the abode, the Brahma Vihara of choice that we go to. We have insight meditation, of course, and then our default from insight meditation is the metta practice for self-kindness. It brings in a sense of connectedness to things, a sense of universality, and just a sense of abiding within everything. But in the Mahayana tradition, the default position outside of insight is karuna or compassion. In fact, I heard the Dalai Lama, someone asked him why he emphasized compassion over emptiness, which is the wisdom component. And he said, very simply said, it's safer. An enormous amount of cruelty can arise from emptiness. What difference does it make what I do to anyone? It's all empty anyway. People can get into that way of thinking, that attitude. But it is harder to do from a sense of compassion, because what compassion, the intentionality of compassion, is to alleviate suffering, not to inflict more upon it. So you can really begin to see how the Dharma has to walk right step, left step with those two qualities. If the compassion doesn't have a component of emptiness, it becomes sort of the romanticized burden and weighted pity that many people feel when you see the suffering. But if it is based in wisdom, wise view, interconnectedness, then it can walk, as I mentioned last week, with what Nisargadatta Maharaj said. What did he say? I can't remember. It'll come back to me later in the talk. But it was good. Oh, I saw. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Compassion tells me I am everything. Between the two I walk. To get stuck in either one of those is to miss the entirety of the path. It's so interesting because with insight practice, you see irreversibly the truth of emptiness, of the fact that there is no abiding entity within any particular aspect of existence, including the sense of me. And it can be kind of a cold disdain. There can be a sort of this feeling of, well, it doesn't matter. And then, but the heart, in that sense of presence, in that sense of absence, the sense of absence is really the sense of self-isolation. Freeing oneself from the sense of self-isolation, things come back into connection. And when things are connected, the heart comes into full bloom. And then when it sees the inevitable sorrows of humankind, it moves out in response to that, the waves, the movement of heart in relationship to the sorrows. And someone once described compassion, and I think accurately, it's like seeing a beautiful sunset disappear. You have that wonderful sense of abiding beauty and calm and repose, but the touch of sorrow to see it passing. Just the touch. Because when you look out from eyes that aren't obscured with selfish isolationism, you inevitably touch the sorrows of humankind. And the heart responds. It can't. How can it help? How can it help to do that? And that's why it's such an engaging, important aspect of the practice, to become embodied in that sense of engaged activity to reduce the sorrow, to do something about that, to move in relationship to it. Now, we have to be careful when we say that, because we all think we're moving in relationship to sorrow, and oftentimes it's confusing the picture rather than really helping it. And so we have to understand what compassion and where compassion comes from in truth. So we'll go into that this evening. But first let me say that sometimes when I read the news, especially in this decade, this century, I almost think to myself, what's the use? It's so pessimistic when I look at the effect that humankind is having upon the climate and upon other facets of the world. And I think, you know, part of me just wants to say, well, just that's it. You know, that's it. But there's a saying in Buddhism that says, even if the sun were to rise in the west, the bodhisattva has only one way. Even if Armageddon were happening today, and the hopelessness and the futility was completely obvious, still, compassion, the movement of compassion is to alleviate suffering. That's it. That's the way of our life. That's it. As the Buddha said, we will stand on love, we will get it thoroughly going, we will be entrenched in it. It is our way, our means, and the only thing that we will employ. That's it. So when the news of the day sends shivers down your spine, as it often does, feel the pain and keep working, because we have no other thing to do. That's it. And then the burden of the heart, you can feel the burden of the heart. You can just feel it as it just grows, and okay. Still, we keep our eyes wide open, and we keep walking right into it. How can that not be? And sometimes especially as you begin to practice and over time, you'll come to these points of where there will be such openings to love, such resonance, deeply felt, resonant to love. It's such a pure state where the mind and heart is elevated beyond, above, almost into another realm, another deva sphere, another realm in which there's just the purity of that. And there's such longing just to remain there, it could be like this. This is the potential that all beings could move to. And yet you don't stay there. You turn back around, you go walk right into the cruelty. You walk right back into the pages of the Seattle Times. You face what the ongoing expression of human sorrow is day after day that brings your back down, brings your feet back down to the earth, so that you're back on solid ground. You're not in the clouds. You're walking every step, the ache of it, every step. And from a compassionate field of perception, you begin to see that there is only pain, that all cruelty, that all separation comes a source, the source of it, is inward pain. There isn't a mind state of cruelty. There's a mind state of suffering. And from suffering comes cruelty. And you see that. You see that. Even the most hideous acts of humankind. And so what can one do when one sees inevitably right in front of us the cause and of the conditionality, the cause of it all, except to jump in? Now, what does it mean to jump in? We have to be very careful of these words. I'm not selecting my words with the subtlety that I mean them. Well, as I was mentioning, the Dharma walks on the legs of wisdom and compassion, and wisdom is the knowing and understanding, the direct knowing and understanding of awareness. That's wisdom. Compassion is the direct knowing and understanding of intentionality, of intentions. So what do I mean by intentions? We spent many, many classes talking about wisdom, and we'll spend many, many more. But this one I want to focus in on intention, the intention. Someone once said that the whole pin of Dharma revolves around motivation. And you can begin to see, as we get clear in ourselves, what it is that drives our action. And where it is that we contract back around ourselves in fear. And what it is that our response to pain. Oftentimes there is some compassion that filters itself through the mental fog and ignorance that most of us carry with us. And we act, but we act in kind of a twisted, like one of those circus mirrors. Instead of a full-length mirror, it's one of those warped kind of undulating mirrors that show, you know, a big this and a small that. And that's sort of the way a compassion reflects back into the world from a mental interpretation of the sorrows of humankind. For instance, just to give you some for instance, it's well-meaning. These are all well-meaning. It's not that they're not well-meaning. It's just that they're distorted from the true pictures of compassion. Inevitably, when someone is in grief, they are surrounded by people who are very uncomfortable with that depth of sorrow and loss. And so the friends of people who are grieving often encourage them to get over it, to get back to work, to re-engage themselves. Again, it's well-meaning, but it's because the friends, the people who are giving this advice, offering this advice, are often unable to hold or feel comfortable within the pain of that grief. And so to get over it, they're encouraging their friend or whomever to get over it, because what they're really saying is, I'm uncomfortable with this. So is that compassion? It's well-meaning, but it's not compassion. Compassion in its heart of hearts doesn't move from pain. Are you hearing a common theme? That all roads lead through Rome. That the central feature is how it is, what is our relationship like to Rome, meaning pain? How we will take 405 instead of I-5 through the center. We'll fly over it. Because therein lies the distortion of the mirror. What road we take. We aren't available to pain. We aren't willing to accept it on its terms. So another distortion of the mirror is pity. It's that sort of hands-off, let me give you something, let me do something for you. You're the one who is needy, not me. And often I feel guilty in my health and seeing your unhealth, my shame for being so wealthy in your poverty. So let me offer you something. It's a whole different way of relating to the underprivileged, is seeing them underprivileged. Instead of seeing them as a human being, compassion always meets somebody as equal, never as less than. If we're meeting somebody as less than we're not meeting them from the compassionate view. Interconnection doesn't have weighted components in it. It's all homogeneously equal. And so for me to be able to look into somebody's eyes who is hurting, first thing that I have to do is to honor the connection of a human being there, from my human beingness. I can't be the wealthy person talking to the poor one, or the famous one talking to the, whatever inequality you want to place upon that relationship. You can't take that stance with someone, or that stance is downhill. And pity is always downhill. So you can see that pity is really the near enemy of compassion. And it's interesting, the first feeling the pain, but first meeting the person as a human being. Because, you see, what happens there is the whole of the story. Because what happens when you meet somebody in equality is that you have no protection anymore. If I meet you as the wealthy person meeting the poor one, I have the protection of my wealth. And even though I give you money, I'm trying to buy off my sorrow for you, pay it off, but I'm still protected within that because it's not happening to me. I'm not the one that's dying. I'm not the one that's lame. See, it was so clear when I would work with the dying. I mean, it sent me through so many hell realms. A friend of mine who was also a hospice clinician said that he had to wake up to his dying every day to be effective. Because you're out there and you're talking to somebody, you're talking to a human being who's alive, not dead, obviously, but who's dying, but who isn't dead. So first you have to connect with the life of that person. And then opening to their situation, the pain of their situation, which is sometimes enormous, and not present any defense against their dying, their own mortality. So you have no protection, therefore, against your own. As soon as you say, well, I'm not the one that's dying, then it's pity. When you open to the common link that we're both mortal, and in the process of dying, both of us, then there's no salvation for either one of us. And there's no defense for either one of us. And that's when it really gets interesting. That's when the reserve units, the Red Guard, fails to defend. There's nothing there. See that helplessness? That is the hardest point. That is absolutely the hardest point that Dharma can take us to. The point of no protection. No shields, not even the thin protection of my clothing. We're naked together. And I have no answers. An easy drift of compassion is pretension. I'll be the doctor. I'll be the consultant. I'll be the clinician. I'll be the counselor. I'll be the nurse. I'll be the social worker. And yes, but how's your drug bills? Let me take care of your, what about, can I fluff your pillow? No, you can't fluff my pillow. My pillow's fine. Oh. See, we want to move to the doing. The doing keeps us, it keeps us engaged so that we don't have to open to the helplessness of it. So then we offer, you see, compassion requires two things. It requires connecting with suffering, and it requires authenticity, being authentic. So what do I mean by being authentic? Well, most people think authenticity is being true to yourself. But if being true to yourself means you just follow every whim of your habit, and your habits are based on conditioning, then being true to yourself is being true to your conditioning. That doesn't make any sense. What I mean by authenticity is being true to reality. So that you see what you're imposing between yourself and reality that keeps you from being authentic. That's why intentionality is at the base or the heart of compassion, because there you're seeing all of the ways that we dance around reality coming to color my connectedness with this person, to protect myself from this person. And so the dance of all of my options, my doing, my fixation, my pretension, my protection, my defenses, my pity, dance across the screen, and I can grab any one of those as my intention in that moment, which allows me some relaxation. And okay, I can back away. When I grab the wrong intention, they're all wrong. The real intention is the meeting of emptiness. Then, see, this is where the heart, this is where wisdom and compassion meet. Where you see that all of the different displays of the mental ways that we protect ourselves are just ways that we're trying to defend ourselves from our heart really being engaged and intimate and vulnerable and being with somebody totally. When you see all the ways that we do that, it's just the way we try to fill up space. And without filling up the space, there's just, when we don't fill up the space, there's just connectedness. It's not connectedness is another thing that fills up space. In the absence of anything filling up space, there's connection. So when we're not protecting, we're connecting. There's another way of saying it. Isn't that interesting? When we're not lost in our impersonation. See that? That's, you see how impersonation comes in there to fill it? We impersonate we're never anything, but then we take on the role of being something to impersonate so that we can protect ourselves from the intimacy and vulnerability and helplessness of not having a job to do. So compassion, you might say, is at the end of doing. So the end of doing, that doesn't sound like it's very engaged. Rodney, you started this talk by saying that compassion is a very engaging, a very active expression of life. And now you're talking about not doing. Well, that's why if we pick up doing too quickly, then our intentions, our intentionality is skewed. The mirror's still warped. We can't pick it up too quickly. We can't, with the dying patient, say, you'll be okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Because one, they may not be okay, and two, you may not see them tomorrow. So what do you say to them? You look better than the last time I saw you, which is... You see, that all of those comments, the social comments that distort the mirror, you can't say it. But you can't say it to anybody. Because all they are is attempts to impersonate. You see what the heart demands? The heart demands to be left alone in order to shine. And we keep yelling our demands at it. But when we leave it alone, it shines. And then action comes from that shining, comes from that display. And that second aspect of compassion, the first is authenticity, which is being true to reality, not to oneself. Being true to oneself doesn't have much meaning when you don't know yourself. But to be able and willing to move into the pain and not have any answers for the pain. That's the second aspect of compassion. It's being mutually helpless. You see, it's in that dismal, when I say helplessness, we project all kinds of dismal grayness into that. Oh, that's what they mean by emptiness, is that kind of, I'm helpless. Desert. No, that's where all of life is. That's where it all arises. That's where all life comes in. That's the creation. That's the moment of the Big Bang. And we each have an allotment of suffering, don't we? And how is it that we are able to handle that internally? How compassionate, in other words, are we with ourselves? How compassionate are we with ourselves when we hurt? How compassionate are we with ourselves? I'm continuing to jog, but I have a growing sciatica in my leg. And I was saying to Ellen tonight, I said, I think I'm reaching the end of my ability to run, to jog. I just isn't getting any better. But I'm not taking care of it either. Right now it's an annoyance. It's keeping me from running the way I used to run. And so I have no compassion for it. It's like this thing that I need to take care of. So what point does my heart actually open to something that needs my attention? Is when it doesn't become, it's no longer an annoyance. As long as it's annoyance that's keeping me from something, then it will forever be just that. I'll never really pay full attention to it because I'm not interested in paying full attention to it. I'm interested in getting over it so I can get on with what my life really needs to be, which is a running life. And so we never fully give our heart to ourselves because we have a picture or an ideal of what ourselves needs to be, and then these lumps keep coming up. We keep getting old, and we keep running into the lumps of ourselves. And so we never really pay attention full-heartedly to the difficulties. We never give them our full caring. I find that. But what about ourselves emotionally? You know, we hurt. Many of us hurt deeply. And yet our heart won't open to that hurt because we're too lost in the definition and defining of what that hurt means to us. That somehow we're not up to the task, somehow we're disadvantaged, or somehow the embodiment of ourselves comes into that hurt. The impatience, the frustration, the annoyance is all about who I am. And so I never give my full attention to those qualities of mine because they represent me and I need to get over them, not abide in them. And I can't ever open my heart to anything unless I abide in it. Not as an annoyance, but as itself, as a legitimate part of reality. Being authentic then is being true to the reality of the moment. Being true to the hurt that I have emotionally or physically without any need to get over it onto something else, but just, okay. That's what being authentic means. And then compassion can arise virtually throughout our mind and body system all the time. But first you have to connect with yourself. See, interconnection, you can't get away from wise view. Wise view is at the basis of all these Brahma-viharas. It's not something that you do to better yourself. It's something that you do to release yourself from the betterment into your authenticity. I don't know if I was watching 60 Minutes, and they had an Israeli hospital that was serving both Israelis and Palestinians. And they were interviewing the Israeli doctors, and the doctors, some of whom were right-wing conservative Jews, some who were, I mean, just the whole range of political spectrum. And to a person, these physicians said that they did not treat the Israeli patient any better than they treated the Palestinian patient. And when asked why, and when explored, the feeling of the program was that when you have to touch somebody, when you have to make physical contact, when you have to do something in relationship to, this is no longer an enemy. All of our ideation, all of our beliefs, all of the things that we impose between ourselves and the person we hate can't sustain itself when you hold the person's hand, when you are digging out shrapnel, when you see the person behind the ideology, when you touch the person behind the ideology. I often think that massage therapists and home health aides and people who, physical therapists, and people who make that physical touch, if they can do it in the spirit of this talk, they have a leg up for most of us who are involved in the intellectual exchange with another person, because you can hold a sense, that sense of belief and ideology from the exchange, because it's just words that you talk. But when you touch the body, when you look into the eyes, when you actually meet the person, which is interesting, most people who are dying, they want their hand held. And for the clinician to be able to hold the hand breaks that protection and allows them to come into their own dying, to be able to hold the patient's hand, to touch the patient, to feel the human quality at the end of that, to feel the pulse, to feel the beat, the rhythms of life there. And that's it. You see, it's not, all the rest of it is just mind-created, steeped ignorance, projected struggle. And so much of the time when we sit, as the practice works sufficiently on you, you'll find that your heart at times will get softer, and in that softness there can be a tremendous relief of grief and sadness that often comes out in tears and sobbing. I still often feel that. For no reason whatsoever, just the tears will just come. And I've lived with it for so long now, I just realize it is another round of the softening of the heart. Another layer of pretension that's being sloughed off. Often after retreats, because of the sensitivity of that onward day-long or week-long or however long you go on, you spend the whole day connecting, interconnectedness. And that to who it is that you are at its base, in the body at its base, right? Not all of this stuff, not all of the things you can do and the all the things you've created and all the ideas you have about yourself. But right there in the body, right at its base, the heart has to fold in on itself. It has to warm itself. It has to, if we're just willing to allow the process to occur, because you come through the layers of defense and then you find yourself heartwarmingly true and authentic. So we practice that. And the practice of compassion, I just want to say a few words about that, is to align ourselves in the direction of suffering, to begin to notice it, not to pretend it's not there or to hide from it, but to legitimately align ourselves in it, so that we begin not to pass over the difficulties into the next thing, but to really focus in on the struggles of life, my own and others. And that's the purpose and intentionality of the homework. And compassionate practice really only has one phrase: may you be free of suffering, may I be free of suffering. Now, if that sounds like a wish, I wish you would be free of, you know, and sometimes people talk about metta and as a wish. Well, it's not, reality isn't like that. So why am I wishing? It's not a wish. So change the words. Say, I care about your suffering. I care that you suffer. Is that a wish? And for when you care about somebody, you don't want them to be suffering. It's not that you're denying the reality that they are, or that you're getting lost and I'll do everything I possibly can, you know, to fix it for you, because fixing it for you may not be what the situation calls for. Leaving the person alone may be what the person is called for. But unless we have sufficient comprehension, sufficient understanding of our intentions, so that we include more of the comprehensiveness, we're going to be acting out of our need for them not to be in pain, which is really our need not to be in pain. And we just keep trying to unload their pain. But pain is the driving engine behind people's growth. So to take their pain away from them prematurely may be to rob them of the very thing that instigates the next level of growth. So you don't want to shovel it out, nor would you. But oftentimes, it's not about being afraid of their pain. It's about seeing it and being available, creating the right environment for that next step to occur so that they can move out organically from their pain if they so wish. And you're there with a hand, and if they grab it, great. If they don't grab it, great. Because you can stay there with them even if they don't grab it. That's a little bit idealistic in the sense that most of us don't have that capacity to move into that depth of pain. But let's know what we're doing. Let us be honest with our intentionality. Let us be honest with what we're trying to do to this person and for this person, and how we're acting, not from what we think they need, but because we can't stand it in ourselves, seeing them suffer. Let's just be honest with that. And now to go back and ask the question, can I hold this pain in myself? Can I feel this pain? Can I just be quiet a little bit with it? Can I just give it a little more space, another inch, another few seconds, where I am growing in my capacity to hold my own difficulty rather than to constantly try to act and react from it? Can I do that? And that's the way of the Dharma. That's the way of growing in compassion and wisdom. Because what will allow you to open and to hold more and more pain is that you're less and less there. That you're more and more empty. You're not going to be able to hold it as a person, It'll kill you every time. But the more empty we become, the more our capacity to hold pain is there, and the more compassionate we become. You see the connection, the relationship between this foot steps, and then this foot can step. And then this foot steps, and then this foot can step again. Both feet. So take the homework. And especially, you know, the compassionate practice, when you say, oh, may I be free of my suffering. I care that I suffer. I care that I suffer. When you say, I really care that I suffer, suddenly your orientation isn't to get over your suffering, it's to care about your suffering. I care about my sciatica. Maybe tomorrow. Right? Maybe tomorrow, that's what we say. Not to get over it. I care about this pain I'm in. Then when you care about it, your whole energy comes into it. But what is the energy for? It's to understand it, not to get rid of it. When you care about something, you're interested in understanding it. You lead with understanding. Understanding doesn't do anything to it. It's not an act of avoidance. It's an act of penetration. It's an act of inserting clarity where there's ignorance, of infusing light where there's darkness. And that's what compassion is about. And understanding is the whole game. So may you all be free of suffering. Can we sit for just a minute or two?